So welcome to the Twilight session. I don't have the paper in front of me with the title of it.
Here.
It is titled, Best Saturday's Werewolf, Vestiges of the Premortal Romance in Stephanie Meyer's Twilight Novel Series. Yes. So, thank you all for coming. Happy to have you all here. We're gonna, that's our title. Please take out your cell phones and turn them off so that they don't make noise, or turn them to vibrate. And I'm going to briefly introduce our speakers and panelists, and then we're going to have a talk and a response for the talk. 30 minutes, 35
minutes? If I talk slow.
All right, yeah. So 30, 35 minutes if you talk slow, and if you talk quickly, we'll have even more time for Q&A. For response, they say 10 to 15, but however much.
Okay. Yes.
So we'll let that work, and then we'll save a lot of time at the end for Q&A because this is a very exciting topic. Now, take a look at there. You see the recording device. So speak up if you're in the back. We may have the people repeat your question just to get it on the microphone. But if you're in the front, it'll probably be okay. And with a group the size, we probably just have people come up and speak near the microphone to get it picked up. So a couple of brief notes before we introduce. Those are the recordings. We do have books. Well, this is about a book, but the book is not for sale here, unfortunately. but there are books for sale. Talk to Tom about those. They're very good. And let's briefly introduce our speakers at this point. Eric Jepson is a writer for the blog A Motley Vision, who's written about Mormon comics, and on his own blog about various Mormon art topics. Such as the role of the erotic in LDS literature. His Mormon-themed fiction is forthcoming in Dialogue. He is editor of the FOB Bible, slated for release later this year. And he homesteads online at thamazing.com. And Maxine Hanks, I'm sure you all know, is a famous feminist theologian who lectures and writes on women's studies in religion and Mormonism. She is the editor of the New York Times bestseller Shattered Dreams, co-author of Women in Authority, which you should all own, author of Mormon Faith in America, and contributor to Secrets of Mary Magdalene. Thanks for coming. I'll turn the time over to Eric Jepson.
Two comments before I start. First, I want to assure you that the books I'm talking about are in print and are available at many bookstores. And I forget what the second one was, but if it comes back to me, I'll be sure to mention. Oh, the other one was I really wanted to thank you for coming, because frankly, right now, I want to be watching the movie. So the fact that you came means a lot to me, because I've missed this movie so many times, and I feel terrible about it. So, yeah. So I appreciate you for coming. On the top of my paper is Saturday's Werewolf, Vestiges of the Premortal Romance in Stephanie Meyer's Twilight Novels. Reflecting on the phenomenal success of Stephanie Meyer's Twilight books, Caitlin Flanagan observed in The Atlantic that the author being a practicing Mormon is a fact every reviewer has mentioned, although none knows what to do with it, and certainly none can relate it to the novel. Some dismissively call her a young Mormon girl who had to sublimate like mad with thoughts of vampires, while others imagine her Mormon identity must somehow now be lost, saying she was a 29-year-old Mormon housewife. And while most agree that her beliefs are key to understanding her singular talents, few, if any, have tried to connect her faith to her work in a meaningful way. The parsing of Twilight's Mormonist has only just begun, but here at the outset, at least one aspect of Meyer's world of vampires and werewolves connects most clearly not to traditional supernatural literature, that of horror, but more closely to the supernatural literature of the Latter-day Saints. Meyer's monsters are traditional in name, vampire and werewolf, and in most respects, they reflect the conventions established for their kind. Her vampires drink blood, and they are strong and attractive. Her werewolves have a human form, and they are violent and hairy. But other aspects of these creatures are unique to Meyer's cosmology, such as the vampire's shiny granite skin or the werewolf's intense body temperature. Among the details that distinguish a Meyer werewolf is imprinting, a sudden and permanent formation of a mate relationship. Jacob, the novel's preeminent werewolf, describes imprinting as an experience akin to gravity. When you see her, he says, suddenly it's not the earth holding you anymore. She does, and nothing matters more than her. Even Meyer's human heroine, Bella, can recognize that an imprinting couple is utterly right together, two puzzle pieces shaped for each other exactly. The vampire Edward compares imprinting to fairies' love spells, like magic. Through imprinting, werewolves find their soulmate. One party is bound to the other and becomes the other's perfect match, like he was designed for her alone. The vampires in the Tetralogy have an experience similar to imprinting. Although the book's characters do not view the experience as being equally immutable, Edward famously and irrevocably bonds with Bella against his will, and other vampires also bond for life. For instance, the clairvoyant vampire Alice shows up in a Philadelphia diner, and when she sees her meant-to-be, she says, "You've kept me waiting a long time." And they are then together ever after. But even though the bond between Edward and Bella drives all four books, Myers' text does not give vampire bonding an emphasis comparable to that of werewolf imprinting. The werewolves of the Twilight books never know if or when they will imprint on someone. Once they become a werewolf during adolescence, they may imprint at any time, and once they do, any prior relationship becomes unsustainable, because an imprinted werewolf can never turn away from their imprintee. This mode of romantic relationship, instigated by sudden recognition, and then lasting eternally, as those of you who were here last night know, bears strong similarity to a type of romantic relationship popular in Mormon literature, not more, since the publication of Nephi Anderson's 1898 novel Added Upon, The Premortal Romance. In basic structure, this narrative begins before mortality, with two spirits developing a romance-like relationship. The parties are then driven towards rediscovering their soulmate during mortality. Then, when found, the moment of recognition between the premortal lovers leads to a forgetting of all prior mortal attachments. From this moment on, the lovers are inseparable in life and death forever. Examining the premortal romance structure provides insight into imprinting and demonstrates how Meyer has taken a classic device of Mormon fiction and expanded it, perhaps exploded it, bringing a moral complexity missing in her progenitors. The two preeminent examples of the premortal romance in Mormon literature are Added Upon and Douglas Stewart's musical Saturday's Warrior. Added Upon's primary couple, Honan and Delsa before birth, Rupert and Signe after, Honan, Delsa, Rupert, Signe, have two imprinting-like experiences. The first is during premortality. Out for a walk, Honan sees Delsa's sweet face and strange one, and is drawn to her immediately above the other spirits surrounding them. When she sees him, a pleased smile overspreads her face. She explains that she has been making a dream picture of her ideal face, and now when he's arrived, her dream face seems to blend with his. Drawn together, they converse, and both faces shine with a soft, beautiful light. The joy within, too deep for words, instinctively they cling to each other. Honan offers the primary point of view through these premortal scenes, and he cannot make immediate sense of his relationship with Delsa. He was drawn to her more than to the many others who were equally valiant. As he thought of it, its strangeness occurred to him. Why should it be so? He did not know. Delsa was fair, so were all the daughters of God. She had attained great intelligence, so had thousands of others. Then wherein lay the secret of the power which drew him to her? He has no answers, and no one around him seems to have had a similar experience. Honan and Delsa's instruction regarding their coming earth life informs them that there is no guarantee of their meeting again once born. Yet they dare to hope that they will, that Father may order it that way. Honan is to leave first, and Delsa tells him, "You will go before and prepare a welcome for me, then I will come." The reader can have no doubt, understood, you know, the given rules of fiction, that these two will consummate their love in mortality. Anderson plays with the expectation, however, withholding identities as the reader strives to match mortal characters to their premortal counterparts, and identifying Rupert as Honan comes rather easily, but the mortal identity of Delsa is uncertain until Rupert meets Signe, and they recognize their shared gravity. From the moment he first hears her voice, he is spellbound, it says, and she, noticing him, looks upon him steadily. Or, as Meyer might describe it, like a blind man seeing the sun for the very first time. Anderson avoids stating Rupert's and Signe's developing relationship in terms of their premortal connection. And knowing that the reader has been waiting for them to meet, he makes it obvious, having Rupert think that God has sent her to me for a purpose, and feel that there was something else about her, an atmosphere of peace and assurance. Rupert believes he understands his thoughts and feelings, but the reader understands their import better. They understand that they signify the couple's premortal relationship. And as they fall in love, Signe teaches Rupert Mormon theology, and he finally posits, "If we ever lived as intelligent beings in a pre-existent state, and I now cannot deny it, or cannot doubt it, we too knew each other there. Perhaps we were the closest friends." Signe reveals she has long felt the same. "Well, I seem to know you from the first. Though you looked bad and like a tramp, I knew you were not. And I felt as if I had known you before." Then they were silent again, reading life's meaning in each other's eyes. From then on, Rupert and Signe are like Meyer's imprinted people. The peace and certainty they always radiate is downright puke-inducing. Meyer. To quote Rupert, quoting Victor Hugo, "When love has blended and molded two beings in an angelic and sacred union, they have found the secret of life. Henceforth, they are only the two terms of the same destiny, the two wings of one mind, or again, in Meyer's terms, a perfect match." Having met immortality, Rupert and Signe are no longer free to pursue other romantic interests. Indeed, they have no need to. Relationship expectations now fulfilled need only be lived and enjoyed. This state of satisfaction will be the end goal for Mormon literature's future premortal romantics. Unlike Adam Pontonen and Delsa, we don't meet Saturday's Warriors premortal romantics Julie and Todd until after they've already been in love forever. As they near the beginning of their Earth lives, Julie panics. What good are promises in a world where everything will be forgotten? But Todd assures her that he will search and he will find her. And as for not recognizing you, that's like saying the sun and the moon and the stars will never recognize their glory, and purity and virtue will never recognize their own. They then enact their future meeting in song, claiming that the circle of our love extends beyond the reach of time, beyond the span of days and years, it goes forever. And so it does. Like Rupert and added upon, Todd's mortal search for gospel truth climaxes with his discovery of lost premortal love. Julie, however, born into a Mormon family, is enwrapped in a quest for love from the beginning. When we first meet her in mortality, she's engaged to Wally, whom she then abandons for Peter, whom she then abandons out of certainty that he is not, in fact, the right one for her. She then returns to Wally, who, as a returning missionary, brings with him the newly converted Todd. Upon seeing each other, Julie and Todd lose sight of the others in the airport and sing to each other the song they last sang in premortal parting in anticipation of this precise moment. I wish I could remember the melody, but this is not one of the songs I can remember. I wasn't here last night to practice, so it seems... I can do like two lines, and when I get to them, I'll take a stab at it. It seems like we talked like this before. Sometime, who can be certain when? But if I knew you then, it's strange I can't remember feelings come so strong. Like we've known each other oh so long. The circle of our love, it goes forever. In God's eternal plan, it goes forever. Beyond the span of days and years, it goes forever. And in true werewolf imprinted fashion, having once seen each other, they are lost to any other potential mates, even to one standing right there. As Julie turns to Todd, she simultaneously turns from Wally, to whom she was previously betrothed. This distinction between the premortal romance and the merely mortal romance is a typical component of the genre. Before meeting Signe, Rupert had been betrothed to another. And the first werewolf to imprint, Sam, had been in a committed relationship with one girl, Leia, before imprinting on another, Emily. But Meyer's handling of the mate swap offers an arguably more mature perspective than her predecessors. When Wally is horrified by Julie's abandonment, his friend tells him it's all part of the plan, remember? And Rupert's fiancée left him, leaving him free to discover Signe without prior obligation. Yet in Meyer's world, for Sam to be with Emily, he must leave his cousin, her cousin, Leia. And that's what happened. He broke Leia's heart. He went back on every promise he ever made her. Quote from the book. This word promise is a key word. Each of Saturday's Warriors' major characters makes premortal promises to be fulfilled while on Earth, and the individual character arcs see these promises met. The script generally avoids having characters make conflicting promises after the veil falls when memory of the old promises is lost, and those who do make conflicting promises must recognize their error and fulfill only the prior promise in order to be happy. Julie's stress and uncertainty is not alleviated until she has her imprinting experience, nullifying her engagement to Wally. And added upon, Rupert's promises were broken not by him, but by another, leaving him morally unconflicted. While the characters in Twilight are not given a premortal backstory, imprinting provides a relationship of similar force and intensity to those characters involved in mortal realizations of premortal romance. Yet, Meyer is not as kind to her characters as Anderson or Stewart, and Sam is forced to cause pain in breaking a mortal promise made prior to his eternal imprinting. Although he is incapable of remaining attached to Leia, every day he has to see the accusation in her eyes and know that she is right. This conflict between promises mortal and eternal and Sam's struggle to resolve them shows a new complexity in the previously simplistic trope of the premortal romance. See one soulmate, then live happily ever after. That was the rule. Julie and Todd's zombie-like devotion and Rupert and Signe's sweet calm assurance has been replaced for Sam by commitment and adoration for his imprinting and simultaneous self-loathing for himself. Meyer's world has fewer pat answers, perhaps because it lacks the pre- and post-life bookends of its predecessors. Yet for any character in these stories, even those with faith in pre- and post-mortal life, during mortality the veil is drawn, and they cannot recall what transpired prior to birth. They do, however, receive timely personal insight regarding their shared past. Julie and Todd experience an instant certainty that the circle of their love began in God's eternal plan, and Rupert and Signe share a glimpse of past glories. But for Meyer's werewolves, there is no simple doctrinal explanation. A compelling devotion is accompanied by broken promises and abandoned love, making any pre-imprinting relationship hazardous and uncertain. If imprinting is indeed a form of the premortal romance, it is a version in which mortal events do not agreeably follow a forgotten script. Yet, this alteration, in addition to making for a more complex fiction, aligns better with a key Mormon concept, agency. The very concept of a soulmate suggests that the question, whom shall I marry, has but one correct response, and that each person must live in fear of inflicting pain on others while seeking a fated imprinting-like experience. Spencer W. Kimball famously said, and his timing suggests he may have been responding to Saturday's Warrior, that soulmates are a fiction and an illusion. An illusion, a mirage, leading one away from self-directed mate-seeking and into a sort of romantic roulette in hopes of accidentally finding the one and only soulmate. But Sam's rejected love, the werewolf Leia, wishes to win this game of roulette, to imprint, so that she may leave the pain of Sam's involuntary rejection and find happiness with another. Leia would prefer to have her agency removed than suffer the consequences of further decisions that end in disaster. She wants her romantic choices made for her correctly, whether that be done by her premortal self, or whether the unknown root cause of imprinting, or whatever, you know, causes imprinting, they don't know. And when Jacob calls her on this desire, telepathically calling it just another way of getting your choices taken away from you, she parries. Sam, Jared, Paul, Quayle, they don't seem to mind, to which Jacob replies, none of them have a mind of their own. They may be happy, but at the cost of their freedom. Meyer allows Jacob to prove his own ability to choose when he leaves his love interest, Bella, and allows her to pursue another. This use of agency places Jacob into romantic agony, and he thus, like Leia, covets the agency-free route, fearing and hoping it may be his destiny anyway. It seemed like maybe getting your choices taken away from you wasn't the very worst thing in the world. Maybe feeling like this was the worst thing in the world. And travels to the Seattle area, to finds a park where he stares at the face of every girl who passes anywhere near him, hoping she will be the one. Finally, he gives up, explaining, it was beyond stupid to think I was going to simply walk into my soulmate, simply because I was desperate to do so. Because one does not choose a soulmate. One's desire for a soulmate is irrelevant. It simply happens. And when it does happen for Jacob, and the imprintee's mother, Bella, takes issue, he can only protest, you know, it's not something I can control, and it wasn't my idea, and it was involuntary. And yet this involuntary imprinting is what finally leads to his happiness. And this is the greatest departure from the prototype in Meyer's version of the premortal romance. Without a window through the veil and into the premortal past, her characters have no recourse, no explanation of events that leaves their ability to choose for themselves intact. They are puppets of compelling romantic happenstance. And though this slavery to destiny allows them to relax into their comfortable permanent relationships, it also brings risk of that destiny, causing irreparable heartache to others as well. Any attempt to resolve the apparent disconnect between agency and happiness requires a return to Meyer's Mormon faith and the climactic event in its premortal narrative. As Honan describes the conflict in Added Upon, the question was whether to retain our agencies to choose, or, without that privilege, cease to be intelligences and become as inanimate things, saved without choice on our part. This, according to Mormon understanding, was the central conflict of premortal life. And Meyer's adaptation of the premortal romance for her werewolves revives the war in heaven here in the mortal plane, showcasing the difficulties inherent in the premortal romance formula, providing neither a glimpse of past glories, nor an atmosphere of peace and assurance, nor a sense of why they're here, nor who they really are. Instead, Meyer's werewolves are left with no comforts other than those given them in relationships they were not allowed to choose for themselves. And Meyer does not allow this question of agency to slip to the side with a manufactured, like, premortal excuse. She has not forgotten that in Mormon doctrine, agency is the specific gift by which God made his children in his image and empowered them to grow to become like him through their own progression of choices. The werewolf's loss of agency in this matter suggests a stock progression and complicates the pack conclusions presented in previous premortal romances. Speaking with Time magazine, Meyer called free will a huge gift from God. By stripping it from her werewolves, by making their happiness dependent upon losing their freedom, she makes an artistic choice that resonates deeper with readers who understand the decidedly Mormon ethos upon which that choice is made. Critics outside the Mormon tradition may not know what to do with Meyer's Mormonness, but Meyer's connection to her heritage is not deeply hidden. The premortal romance, one of the longest-standing traditions of Mormon literature, is just one example of how Meyer's work places her within that tradition. By highlighting the conflicts between the premortal romance concept and the essential Mormon precept of agency, Meyer is not only continuing the Mormon literary tradition, but is challenging one of its oldest patterns of storytelling. The end.
Is there a mic somewhere that's picking up?
The mic
is right there. Right there. Oh, okay. I was lost.
Mike said that it would pick you up.
So. I brought a strawberry as a visual aid. There were no apples on the table. I think that the Twilight series is a very Mormon work. In fact, it's a Mormon phenomenon. Stephanie Meyer's been called the Mormon Anne Rice. Mormon mom and BYU grad, Stephanie Myers created a myth so compelling her Twilight series has sold 42 million books worldwide, and the film version of Twilight has grossed $188 million. Myers has sold more books than any other Mormon author, I think, except Joseph Smith, or Mormon, as your view may be, and Orson Scott, well, except Joseph Smith, and is the most commercially successful Mormon writer since Orson Scott Card, her role model, and Stephen Covey. She's the biggest publishing phenomenon since J.K. Rowling. The Twilight DVD is the most heavily pre-ordered movie in Walmart history, outpacing Harry Potter and Spider-Man. It's interesting. I looked up the Wikipedia list of bestsellers. Of course, the Bible is number one, all-time bestsellers of books. The Bible is number one. Mao's Little Red Book is number two. The Quran is number 10. Book of Mormon, or Quran is number 9. Number 10 is the Book of Mormon. Number 21 is the Da Vinci Code. Number 25 is Anne of Green Gables. 31 is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. 32, if you count all four books, is the Twilight series at 42 million copies. Beating Gone with the Wind, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. So I wanted to give that introduction simply because I think it's very Mormon, and as I said, a Mormon phenomenon. Reacting to Eric's paper, you know, I have a couple of comments because I thought it was such an excellent paper, but I don't have much in the way of critique. I love the fact that, I want to start by saying his appeal to these quotes and comments about how it's a Mormon work, nobody knows what to do with it, certainly no one can relate her Mormonness to the novel, and the fact that few of any have tried to connect her faith to her work in a meaningful way, I would actually say that that's a very big part of the response. Stephanie Meyer herself has related her Mormonness to her work in public, and many people out on the web, including Jana Rees and bloggers, have been dissecting the Mormon aspects of the Twilight series, and it's quite a popular activity. In fact, there's one whole article on the web that's all about the Mormon racism in Stephanie Meyer's novels. I actually kind of like that article. But I really love Eric's very close, focused exploration of actually what I see as three themes. He says he's focused on one theme of imprinting, but he not only focuses on imprinting, or the eternal soulmate, pre-existent soulmate theme, but also agency, and also relationship, the nature of relationship. And I completely agree with everything he said. I mean, it was such a beautiful argument that he made. There are only a couple of things I would say to maybe critique what he said. I love the way he differentiated between the lack of agency that the werewolves have and yet the agency that is there in other characters. I think that the imprinting, Stephanie Meyer is engaging that with her vampires as well, through Bella and Edward. The vampires are seeing each other, bonding and bonding for life, particularly Edward with Bella. But in their case, the agency is involved, and the triangle of imprinting, agency, and relationship work together in a very Mormon, utterly Mormon way for Bella and Edward because of all the ups and downs and the agency that's involved. But I agree that with the werewolves, the agency is removed. And yet I think the imprinting aspect is very present in the vampire relationship as well. So that was one slight difference that I would cite. I think that also by engaging the imprinting aspect of the novels, Eric has keyed in on the very central premise of the novels, the thing that has made them so popular, the thing that has made them so addictive, which is the nature of relationship. Is it eternal? The nature of a committed relationship. You know, along with my thoughts about the bond between Edward and Bella, you know, there are so many comments that they both make. Edward saying, "Do you know how long I've waited for you?" Both of them saying, we can't turn away from this. No matter where it takes us, we can't. Bella's committed to it, even if it means death and resurrection as a vampire. So they're going to be together forever. But also, these three themes are just three of many Mormon themes in Twilight. So what I wanted to do was branch out and hit some of the other themes and just work through them quickly because, as I said, I think it's an utterly Mormon work. I'm interested in Twilight because Stephanie Meyer is a Mormon woman who has written a work of myth and theology that is a self-confession of her own deeper psychology. And I consider it not a strong literary work, but an eminently theological and religious work, and utterly a psychological work. And I think it's very brave for a Mormon woman to confess the contents of her own subconscious and her dreams. And I think it's very brave for a Mormon woman to be doing theology that both partakes of Mormonism and transcends, moves beyond into territories that Mormonism hasn't ventured. Very creative and brave. It both includes and exceeds Mormon theology. I want to read a few quotes from Stephanie Meyer. She says, "Unconsciously, I've put a lot of my basic beliefs into the story. Mormonism has a huge influence on I am and on who I am and my perspective on the world, and therefore on what I write. I was looking to put a lot more light than darkness in the books." She said, "People see allegories there all the time that I didn't put there, and they often get them quite wrong. I try to write books about plain old humans." I found that very interesting. So we'll see if we translate Stephanie Meyer correctly here. In terms of mentioning some of the other themes, there are so many Mormon themes in her books that, you know, I listed about 10 or 12. The vision and dream theme, the theme of a seer. The Book of Mormon shows up. Marriage, the importance of marriage shows up. Motherhood is a major theme. Morality, theology, and let me see, got a couple more here I wanted to mention. Free agency, of course, which Eric mentions. Immortality, so we've got several. And I want to, having just made only that critique of Eric's paper, which is not very much, but it was the only one I really could find that I disagreed with, I found myself also wondering, though, if maybe Charlie, the book Charlie, isn't explicitly about a pre-mortal romance, but I found a lot of the soulmate bond theme in Charlie. Anyway, so back to the Mormon themes. I want to just mention and quote Stephanie in a few places regarding some of the other Mormon themes in her work. Regarding vision and dream, Stephanie said, "I wanted to dream. The concept for twilight came in a dream or vision. I woke up at 4 in the morning from an extremely vivid dream where I was an observer. The dream was vivid, strong, colorful. It was a conversation between a boy and a girl, which took place in a beautiful sunny meadow in the middle of a dark forest." You've all heard this quote, but the boy and the girl were in love with each other, and they were discussing problems involved with that love. The boy was more beautiful than the meadow. His skin sparkled like diamonds in the sun. He was so gentle and polite, yet the potential for violence was very strong. Basically, I'm relating this to Mormonism because she's a seer. She's a visionary. She journeys to another place, an alternate reality, that she enters through an act of creative imagination or subconscious. And I would relate that to Joseph Smith very much. And she visits and sees this other world, and she comes back and reports and writes the story that she sees. And in a way, her dream in the middle of the night is Edward is an immortal figure who appears to her in the middle of the night and reveals this new reality to her, this story that she comes back and writes. And interestingly, like Joseph Smith, she's creating a new theology in a way. And she's utterly true to her own vision. She says, "I can't read other things when I'm writing." She's just completely focused on that interior vision and reality. She says, "In fact, I suppose the psychological challenge was accepting that Edward and Bella weren't real people. I still don't entirely believe that." So, in a way, she's functioning as a voice between worlds, I think. Let's see, there was another point I wanted to make about that, which I forgot. Anyway, on to the next point, the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon is a strong theme in her works, which she herself says. She says that the Book of Mormon is the book with the most significant impact on her life. And her process, oh, this is the point I was going to get at. I found it fascinating that she starts in the middle of the book and writes to the end, and then she goes back to the beginning and picks up picks up the story and takes it to the middle. And again, that's what Joseph Smith did with the Book of Mormon. After he lost the 116 pages, he keeps going where he's at, and he goes to the end, receiving this revealed text. Then he goes back at the beginning and writes the beginning and catches up to the middle where he had originally left off. So I found that a fascinating parallel. Despite very little writing experience in 3 months, she transformed her dream into a novel. Well, same with Joseph Smith. Once she'd had the dream, she wrote like a madwoman struck by lightning, barely able to sleep. Joseph Smith produced the Book of Mormon in a matter of months. I had no outline of where the plot would go or while I was writing from the last half. I wrote from the middle to the end and then went back and wrote from the beginning until the two pieces matched up. To be honest, I felt like I was guided through that process, she says. And again, I really liken that to Joseph Smith. Myers said that, so back to the Book of Mormon. Myers said that one Mormon woman who reviewed Twilight analyzed how it tied to the Book of Mormon. She was dead wrong at every tie-in. Although there was one deliberate Book of Mormon reference, Myers says, that the reviewer missed. Myers' favorite Book of Mormon story about the 2,000 stripling warriors from the Book of Alma. Myers sees her werewolves as the stripling warriors. I found that fascinating. The Mormon allusion I picked up to the Book of Mormon was the lineage of Ephraim Black and Jacob Black. You've got the tribes of Israel and the stick of Joseph and the stick of Judah. Ephraim being from Joseph, Jacob being Israel, being Judah. So that was interesting to me. And of course, she's got these two peoples who are in conflict, a darker, lower order of person, and supposedly the werewolves, and then the vampires who are white and delightsome. So she's got these two groups at war and in conflict. In fact, she even says, this was kind of a shocking comment, let's see if I can find it. She talks about the Native Americans, let's see, the history of the Book of Mormon, in the history of the Book of Mormon, they would have been dark-skinned, the ancestors of the Native Americans who are here now. So for me, the Quileute tribesmen are those kinds of sons who have taken on that responsibility of taking care of their families. So she's likening the werewolves to the dark-skinned people in the Book of Mormon, which I found interesting. Okay, I'll leave that theme of the Book of Mormon. I'm skipping around to some other Mormon themes. I'm adding upon Eric's Mormon theme here. Marriage, another huge theme in her books, and again, which he keys on, the notion of marriage, eternal marriage, and relationship. I would say her books are eminently about marriage. In fact, the compelling factor in her books is relationship and marriage. And I've humorously termed her series as Stephanie's Search for Happiness with Edward Cullen, Eternal Companion. It's about ideal love, true love, total commitment, a mate for life. People have asked her, has there ever been an Edward in your life? She said, no, I wish. I've had very typical, normal human relationships my whole life. Edward is too perfect to exist in reality. I've had these perfect men in my head all the time, but every time I get up from the computer and step out of the writing haze, I have to realize that, yet again, none of them are real. It breaks my heart over and over. I have so many comments, I don't know where to... I think she really explores the notion of a relationship in a very deep way, the conflict. And I think she explores a very traditional notion of codependency, relying on a man to save you, and at the same time struggling with how do you find yourself in that consuming relationship. The desire for a man to save you, and at the same time the finding of your own self, your own strength. She explores motherhood. Motherhood is a major theme in the book, in the way that, of course, Bella has to sacrifice herself, her desire for her child, and the sacrifice for that. Jana Reese says the most obvious Mormon influences in Twilight can be seen in the ways that Meyer has her teenage heroine stand up for marriage and ultimately motherhood. Anyone who is familiar with the book can discern these deeper themes. There's so many themes. Morality, the way that she engages morality, and the morality that she infuses in the books. The passion is wild but chaste. There's no sex before marriage. Meyer herself was a late bloomer who was only holding hands at 16. A relative of Meyer's said, Edward and Bella could barely touch or kiss for fear that Edward might get carried away and suck her blood in a fit of passion. It's very similar to two young BYU students who aren't yet married and can't touch each other for fear it will lead to sex. I'm sure it was easy for Stephanie to describe that experience firsthand. This was a relative of hers. Anyway, so the Mormon morality is there. And lots of people have talked about that. There are so many things I can talk about. Theology, she engages theology in so many interesting ways. Edward is a God-man. He's a translated being. He's not celestial. He's terrestrial. He's immortal, but he's not eternal in a celestial way. Jana Reese also brought up this point that Edward, Edward's definitely immortal, but he's a translated type. Even her description of Edward and the way he looks, he was a normal human being, and then he went through a change that turned him into an immortal. The theme of the God-man is extremely powerful. He's a sublimated desire in every woman and every Mormon woman. I wonder, what do Mormon women dream of? Do they dream of God-men, monstrous gods, vampires? What do they dream of? She's confessed the contents of her own subconscious. So she's telling us what a Mormon woman does dream of. He's an interest. Also, the overwhelming, obvious point that you see is that she's taken the vampire myth and she's created a Mormon vampire. This is a uniquely Mormon vampire, or a vampire angel, and that's very, very interesting. She explores a unique intersection of vampirism and Mormonism. I also saw a touch of polygamy in there, or actually polyandry. She plays with polyandry in the relationship between Bella, Edward, and Jacob. I like that. I want to bring that point out. Because there is a bond. She feels a spiritual husbandry with both of them. And Joseph Smith, who often talked about the notion of a premortal or an eternal relationship in terms of the spiritual wife, someone with whom he had a bond before he came to this world, and therefore he recognized that bond in those who he identified as his spiritual wives. I would say in this book, Stephanie has turned that around, and Bella has recognized an eternal spiritual bond with two males. And I like that. So, let's see. Jana Reese says, in Mormon theology, we make a distinction between the concepts of immortality and eternal life. They seem like they would be interchangeable terms, but they're not. Immortality is the simple continuation of physical existence, a free gift to every person. Eternal life, however, is a spiritual designation. In the Twilight books, Meyer is leading us to a greater understanding of the chasm that exists between these two concepts. Edward, who is damnedly immortal, understands that chasm too well. She engages Mormon themes of redemption, free agency. Stephanie Meyer says, in my books, free agency is a big theme, as is sacrifice. The theme of overcoming the natural man and achieving the status of a transformed divine or good person in spite of overwhelmingly animal or fleshy or what's the term? I've forgotten the term.
Impulses.
What's that?
Impulses.
Carnal. I think carnal desires. He overcomes many of his carnal desires. Immortality and eternal life. I'll finish up here. The theme of immortality and eternal life, Stephanie says, when you live forever, what do you live for? I think this is the overwhelming central theme, Bella's search for immortality. It's about a human being craving, needing immortality, being willing to do anything to get it. Craving immortality in this life. And that's where I'll stop. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks to both of our speakers. This was excellent. Let's, for those who have questions, if you're sitting close, just raise them. Otherwise, if you can just kind of come up and kind of talk towards this microphone, that'll save us the time of having to repeat them. So who would like to, who has a question for our panelists? Go ahead.
Could I just ask a little bio of this Stephanie person? Is she married? What's her life like?
Yeah, what is Stephanie's life like?
She's married and has three kids.
Yeah, she's married and has three kids. She went to BYU, graduated with a degree in English. And it's interesting. What's that?
34? 35?
I think, yeah, she's in her mid-30s. I think it's interesting that, I didn't bring this up, but She talks a lot about how she had just had her third child and she was bored. She said, I love my children, but I just felt like my life wasn't going anywhere. And she felt compelled to find something beyond her status. And I find that interesting. I also wondered about postpartum depression. She had just had her third child. If that might have something to do with the dream. But there's a kind of a boredom there that propels her to search deeper inside of herself.
I just wondered if you had heard that Maxine Wells, when she came to this America, a whole...
Charlene Wells?
Yeah.
I would love to be Charlene Wells, but I'm not.
Well, that a whole group of guys at BYU realized she was their premortal.
Yeah. They imprinted? Do you want to comment on that?
No.
Yeah, it is interesting how the imprinting story gets, you know, you see Big Love where somebody, you know, says, I've prayed and you're to be my eternal spouse, and it actually doesn't work.
Yeah, my wife and I have talked about this in regards to the paper, and I think this isn't just a Mormon idea. I think there's some like human impulse, but the difference is we provide a theological framework on which to hang this idea, and so I think it carries a little more weight in the community than it might in other you know, cultures or demographics.
I find it interesting when reading the book, this focus on marriage, that Ella is so focused on marriage, particularly where in the book her parents, and it's been a while since I read it, her parents had either recently divorced or they were divorced, and she'd gone from living with one custodial parent to the other. And I don't know, what did you think about that? You know, on one hand, there wasn't a very strong vision of married couples in the book. But on the other hand, Bella just had this compelling need to be married to Edward before they did anything.
I think that's
the other way around. Or was Keeble wanting to be married? Okay.
Yeah, she was repulsed by the idea of marriage.
Okay. I was just going to say that. That actually, I think the book explores both sides. I think Stephanie Meyer is processing her own conflict about marriage in Bella. And so Bella is not interested in getting married. And there's a great quote in the book where she says, I don't think of marriage as eternal. I mean, that blew me. That jumped off the page when I don't think of marriage as something that's eternal. And yet at the same time, she meets Edward and all of a sudden, that's all she wants. So I think Stephanie's exploring both sides of that, the avoiding marriage, really wanting to avoid it, and at the same time being compelled for some other reason against your will. Did you have a comment?
No, I think that covered it fairly nicely. Thank you.
What other questions?
Want to share your own Twilight store experiences?
What kind of question?
Twilight testimonies?
Depends. What is it about Twilight that has touched on the universal consciousness or zeitgeist? I mean, why is this Mormon book is hitting... I mean, you've both described it as explicitly Mormon in a lot of themes. Why is it hitting such a chord with people in the country today?
We had a discussion about that at the Sunstone Christmas party, and by the time we got done, a couple of us were in the corner, and I posed that question to Holly Welker and a couple of other people. Everyone at the party suddenly was inexplicably sucked into the room where we were talking, and everyone became part of the discussion, and it went on till 1 a.m. So it was sort of an illustration of the addictive power of Twilight. I think there are a lot of things going on, but what I said that night and during that discussion, and we're going to take up that theme at Sunstone in Salt Lake in August, so we're going to have a panel about this, but I think that she's accessed the subconscious desire for the ideal relationship, but I think that it's utterly psychological. She's tapped into a number of sublimated repressed desires within the psyche, particularly the female psyche. I think that she is looking not only for the ideal man, but her own animus, the masculine within herself, her anti-self. Stephanie Meyer has written an amazingly tight, paradoxical, intense look at a subject-object relationship. And I think that she's somehow been able to access the masculine part of her own psyche in dialogue with the feminine part of her own psyche by personifying them and engaging them in a relationship. And I think it's drawing people in for reasons they don't even understand.
The only thing I'd add to that is I don't have an answer to that question, and if I did, I probably wouldn't tell you, because I think one of the things that's interesting about, because I've observed a lot of these conversations about what makes Twilight such a zeitgeisty sort of thing, and I think the amount of disagreement on the question is part of the reason that the question exists in the first place. It's working complexly and not simply.
It's not simply. I should add to that that, you know, it reveals her psyche, but our reaction to Twilight reveals something about our own psyche. And the dark images, being able to confront danger and violence and the darkness of society, I think that's a big part of it. Here's a helpless, ordinary girl who's suddenly confronted by these terrifying forces that are out there, and she has to negotiate that and survive it, and she's transformed and she triumphs. I think in the teenage mind out there, this is a scary time in life, and the world is going crazy in some ways. And there are so many forces out there that are scaring people, and I think Bella is this heroic figure who teenagers can relate to in a post-9/11 world. Too.
Oh, I was just going to say there's a hand in the back.
There's a hand. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm not disagreeing, but I think there's something else at work, too. Kamoy once, who teaches at the University of Utah, I went there for a master's of fiction and dropped out within a month, but he used to say, you can't write a great book if you believe in God. If you believe in God 10% or 90%, then you can write a book. It probably won't be great. But I think the Mormons have found a way to escape that. Orson Scott Card and Stephanie Myers are kind of off in science fiction, but also Stephanie Myers was writing a romance anyway. I have to admit I haven't read it and didn't plan to, but now that I've heard you guys, I'm going to go buy the damn book.
Just borrow it from a 14-year-old girl in your ward.
That's right. It's also addictive. I forgot to mention the addiction factor. I really think it's the answer to that question is psychological. It's a psychological answer. But it's addictive. The book itself is addictive. It engages the nature of an addictive relationship. It engages an unhealthy relationship with a violent man, this woman who thinks she can redeem him. She thinks she's safe with him. There are a lot of negative aspects to this relationship that are scary, and yet she triumphs in her own way, in a way. But I think the series is psychologically addictive for people.
I haven't read them, I'm not going to. But I heard some psychologists talk on the radio about PBS, and she was saying in this world where every eighth grade girl is expected to give oral sex to every boy who comes along, it's a nice thought that here's someone who wants to take care of her, mm-hmm. who protects, you know, desperately wants to protect. I haven't read them, so I don't know how. But the other thing I thought about when you started talking about imprinting was, I don't know how many of you have had boys come back from missions and say, I talked to God, he said, you're the one for me. You know, how awkward that must be. I know that this happened to, the young man who was going to marry me went on the mission, came back, I was married to somebody else. Said to a young lady at BYU, you're the one for me. And she was engaged to somebody else, just about to get married. You know, how, and she did marry the other person. How awkward this must be for a young woman. You know, I don't know what you do when that happens. But it must be awful.
You know, back to
that happens. You run.
Oh, yeah. You know, back to that theme of the more idealized love, of the more chaste kind of relationship than you see in other romance novels. That's, a key part to the success and I think the appeal of this book, because it's evoking that courtly love, the medieval romance, the notion of worshiping and adoring someone from afar and not harming them, being their protector, you know, the knight and the lady and all of that. And that's engaging a very archetypal pattern inherent within us. And I think, again, it harkens back to this deep, deep-rooted desire that I think all of us have, women and men, for this idealized relationship that will transform us, that will turn us into the eternal part of ourselves. And I think it's really about our relationship to the divine. I think Edward is an archetypal figure for a part of herself she's trying to get in touch with.
Well, I thought about nuns, too, while you've been talking.
Right.
I thought about the idea of, I never have to make another decision as long as I get. You know?
Yeah.
Being the mother of five, I can really relate to the idea of being a nun. And I wonder if she, you know, here's somebody who's made the decision for her. You're for me. You know, I don't make the decision. He's made.
I think that Stephanie is engaging the Mormon concept of eternal marriage, but she's engaging it in a whole new way, and she's exploring the light and the dark side. of eternal marriage. I think she's exploring the light and the dark side of all relationship. The dangers.
No, it is so simplistic you can't figure out why you keep reading.
Well, there is the problem that the narrative is 500 pages of endless teenage small talk. Very hard to get through.
Yeah, Anthony Trollope said that the worst thing that can happen to you is success, and hopefully it won't happen to you while you're too young. And my great fear is that this is what's happened to Stephanie Meyer, because these books are so successful, no one's ever going to dare tell her to edit something, and no one's going to teach her. And I think they're, and I didn't realize this until I really started working on the paper, I didn't expect my conclusion to be that she's done things, she's improved things, like she's brought new depth and complexity to Mormon literature. I didn't expect to say that because I read them, right, or some of them. But the thing is, she has, and I hope that someone, like, you know, maybe she'll have, you know, writer friends or something who will help her become a great craftsman and be able to craft really good fiction, because I think the ideas she has deserve a better written book, and I hope that early success doesn't ruin her as a writer, because she could turn into something really wonderful.
Very well said.
Why don't you write that and send everything?
I'll be happy to read her next manuscript if she asks me.
This has been great, but unfortunately we are now officially out of time. So just when it was getting fun too.
I know we want to